welcome to Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. I'm your host, Andrew Heaton, as far as you know. And today we're going to talk about the transgender military ban. I have brought on Karina Magyar. She is a stand-up comedian to join me and make sense of it. But before we dive into any of that, we do have to pay the bills, and that means a word to our sponsors. We're from our sponsors. You can take your pick on the preposition there. Either way, Something's Off with Andrew Heaton is brought to you by Spam Strangler, the anti-robocall and anti-telemarketer service, which not only blocks unsolicited sales calls, it tracks down the caller and harasses them at their own personal residence. It's a somber day. It's the day of your Aunt Agatha's funeral. In a few minutes, you and the other pallbearers, and one very confused ring bearer, will escort her earthly remains to the cemetery. But for now, you're at the cathedral. And while it's odd to describe a funeral service as posh, this is definitely on the high society end of memorial services. That makes it not only a sad day, but a stressful one. For starters, you're quite keen to marry a young woman named Madeline Bassett, whose stuffy, judgmental parents are seated in the front row. You'd like to think that they wouldn't judge you at your own dear Aunt Agatha's funeral service, but you know, if you slip up and make a scene, they will. And then you won't be able to marry Madeline, and you will die alone. Not only that, the bishop himself is giving the eulogy. His attendance adds to your stress, because you're hoping to be promoted from tenor to subdeacon. You sure don't want to embarrass yourself in front of the bishop by doing something inappropriate. Finally, it's simultaneously your high school reunion. Technically, the reunion starts in an hour, but the sock hop is in the cathedral's basement, so everybody's just hanging out at the funeral service for the time being. It's been a decade since you graduated, and you want your old classmates to know that you've grown into a respectable adult, no longer prone to gaffes or social faux pas. The last mourner is escorted to her pew by a cathedral bellhop, and the service begins. As the organist plays a tasteful hymn, there's a brief announcement over the cathedral intercom, reminding congregants that smoking is strictly prohibited during the service, that mourners should only get up to use the bathroom when the cabin light is on, and, of course, to turn their phones to airplane mode for the duration of the church performance, to ensure that no unwanted calls should ruin the service. You think about checking to confirm that you've already set your phone on silent, but as you reach your hand into your pocket, Madeline Bassett's father gives you a withering look. You pull your phone out now, he'll think you're texting. So you just fiddle with your seatbelt and avoid eye contact. There's an epistle reading, several hymns, and touching speeches from Aunt Agatha's children. After intermission, the bishop ascends the lectern and addresses the congregation. He gives a comforting homily about the meaning of life and death, some heartwarming stories about Aunt Agatha's childhood, and he tops it all off with a speech from Independence Day that the president gives before they go off to fight the aliens. Overall, it is a top-notch eulogy. Sure would be terrible if you or anyone else derailed the otherwise impeccable service at this point. Then the bishop says, "Let us take a moment of silence, for during this very important moment, we commend Agatha's soul to the great beyond. So it's important to be silent, absolutely silent, at this point. Not just out of reverence and general decorum, but because at this critical juncture, if anyone should disrupt the service, it will disorient Agatha's soul. Unable to pass to the next realm, she will grow lost and forever roam the earth as a shade, like those freaky ghost kings from Lord of the Rings." Oh no, it's your phone! But what doofus would call you right now? All of your friends and family know that you're at a funeral. You jam your hand into your pocket to turn it off. Oh no, it's your pager! It's vibrating so loud, everyone can hear it. You turn that off too. Oh no, it's your burner phone! Now everyone knows you've got a secret, anonymous phone you use to sell edibles to college students. This is terrible! How embarrassing! You rush out of the narthex into the bathroom, which is unisex because you're Episcopalian. "What? What is it?" you demand, putting the phone to your ear. "Hello. If you'd like to expand your credit rating, press 1 to speak to a qualified specialist about how to obtain a new and exciting credit card offer." Looks like you should have got Spam Strangler when you had the chance. Spam Strangler not only blocks unwanted robocalls to your phone, it traces those calls back to their origin and then relentlessly harasses the company's owner at their residence. Spam Strangler doesn't just prank call them at work, it goes to the homes of robocall company owners and roots through their garbage to look for prescription medicine labels and credit card receipts, then tweets all of it out and all of the other embarrassing information they can find. Spam Strangler, buy yourself some time, attention, and vengeance. My guest today is Karina Magyar. She is a stand-up comedian out of Austin, Texas, and is going to help me sort out the transgender military ban. Karina, thank you for coming on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and I will, so to kind of preface this, I'll work through a little bit of the chronology, and then we'll jump into it.
Okay.
We'll talk about the transgender military ban. It would seem to me that the two groups that I'm most interested to hear from are transgender folks like Karina, who's coming on, or people in the military, who I might bring on in the future, too. So if you're at home going, why is he only talking to a stand-up comedian about this? Know that I might in the future bring on other stand-up comedians who are also from the military. Unless, Karina, you are a service person, in which case I'm knocking this out of the park right now.
No, I'm so sorry.
Okay. Well, we'll rely on you for being funny and the demographic in question.
I will be funny as a coward, yes.
Good. Perfect. That's about where I'm at. I'm in the funny, cowardly. I was talking to a couple of people that have been in the armed forces about this issue because I wanted to try and get the nuances of this. And they, at one point, one of them brought up, how would you handle barracks issues? You know, where do you put transgender people in the male or female? And I drew a blank and I went, whenever I watch Battlestar Galactica, everybody just sleeps in one big bunk. Is that not how it works? And they were like, no, that's you know nothing. I went, yeah, that sounds about right. I know Battlestar Galactica pretty well. I'll work us through the chronology and then we'll kind of get into it. So for a while, I think transgender people couldn't openly serve in any capacity in the military, and it was one of the things that was knocked out. I think the phrase for a long time was transsexualism. That changed in 2016 with then Secretary of Defense Carter. He introduces what's called the Carter Doctrine, and the Carter Doctrine basically paved a way for openly transgender people to serve in the military. So once somebody went through official channels, they could transition genders, and then they were officially that gender within a military context. So for birthing, barracks, bathroom, all of that stuff, the preferred gender of the service person was how they would be identified. Now, in 2017, there's a reversal on Twitter from the commander-in-chief, President Trump, who says, we are not doing any of this. We're going to stop bringing them in. I think the actual quote, I'll go ahead and read it just so we've got the full context. Trump tweets, after consultation with my generals and military experts, please be advised that the United States government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. Our military must be focused on decisive and overwhelming victory and cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs and disruption that the transgender in the military would entail. Thank you. Now, that is modified by General Mattis, who has left recently, but he is the progenitor of the Mattis Doctrine, which is kind of what we're going off of now. So Mattis further clarifies the president's tweet. He basically breaks it down into a few different categories. Mattis says if you were transgender under Carter and you came out as transgender, that's fine. You're exempted from the ban as it exists now. If you're transgender, it basically becomes a don't ask, don't tell policy, insofar as I can tell. So you're okay to be in the military if you're transgender, but it does knock you out if you have gender dysphoria, which is to say if you've been diagnosed with emotional duress from having a different gender than you identify with, that knocks you out. And there are a couple of other exceptions as well. So it does become a little bit more nuanced. On my end, having been reading a fair amount about this, I think I can break this down for my purposes into basically one of two camps. I think when it comes to the transgender military ban, there's an ick factor and a kill factor. And the ick factor, which I think is more along the President Trump's tweet, is I think this is yucky, or at least that's what I'm inferring. I think that that's what some of the things are going on. I think this is yucky. We don't want them in the military. I'm very much against that. I think, you know, banning people from the military because you think they're icky is not a very good thing. The kill factor I find more interesting, and that to me would be basically saying the identity of the person is not really important, but if there is some sort of associated issue that could mitigate their capacity to kill people or might make them more likely to be killed, then we're not going to let them in. And at that point, I go, okay, well, that actually kind of makes sense to me if we're getting into like the nuts and bolts of military preparation and that kind of thing. So that's about where I am. I kind of separate into the ick factor and the kill factor. long intro. Karina, what do you think?
I was suppressing a lot of laughter at the timeline because I find this whole back and forth that we've been going through kind of hilarious. But I think you've done a great job breaking it down to this ick and kill factor. I think the ick factor is what's really driving this. And I think that's what's driving any political action or discussion that's going on right now regarding transgender issues. It's all being mostly brought up by what I would call the social conservative part of America that mm-hmm. is icked out. I think if it weren't for that kind of section of our society, none of this would be really talked about or dealt with, because it's such a small, tiny, minuscule percentage of the population, and also that minuscule part of the population is doing such a small, internal, small, self-contained, I'm saying small a lot, self-contained
statistically
thing.
You're right, though. It's not a huge amount of people.
It's not a huge amount of people, and what those people are asking for is kind of, unlike sexuality, involves pretty much nobody else. It's we're not even asking to f- you know what I mean? Like, we're not trying to engage with anybody else. So that's what is amusing about, to me. I've decided to make it an amusing thing.
Well, I'd rather keep it funny, so I like where your head's at. And yeah. I think you're right, too, in that it's interesting to me to watch the whole timeline of this, because it's become such a cultural flashpoint. And it from what I can tell, I guess maybe 2014, 2015, that's when North Carolina passes a statewide ban on transgender people using bathrooms, which I looked at the time and went, this does not seem to me to be an actual concern, safety or otherwise. Statistically, mm-hmm. this is such a negligible thing. It seems to me that it doesn't really even need to be dealt with by the state. It's not an issue. But that kind of kicked it into the national conversation. And then after that, it became a sort of the culture war devoured it and made it, you know, a thing that you either have parades about or that you're trying to stop from infiltrating the insidious role of, the American life and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
I'm actually kind of curious because you're transgender and you've I think you transitioned prior to the bathroom bill. Is that something that you wanted thrust into the spotlight? Because a lot of the time this becomes an argument and a flashpoint where these kind of two cultures, the progressives and the social conservatives, are really clashing on it. I actually don't know if I were transgender that I'd really want this to be a huge societal issue. Maybe I'd want to be quiet. I don't really know. I'm kind of curious as to what your thoughts are.
No, I don't. I mean, obviously, if this just wasn't debated, it'd be a lot easier for every trans person in America. However, because people have been transgender since prior to 2004.
It wasn't invented then?
No, it wasn't. Okay. And they've been using the bathrooms, and it's been fine. And so as a trans person, I did not want this to be debated. However, as a comedian, it was freaking gold. It was so good for me. So I was welcoming it in that sense. And I particularly welcomed Diamond Texas. Texas made an attempt to pass a very similar bill to the one that North Carolina did. It failed due to some very reasonable Republicans saying, we don't even want to deal with this in this agenda. We have real things to deal with. But
it goes to him, which, and I got to say, there is a substantial and overlooked element in America, particularly in middle America, that kind of boils down to, like, what's he want to do from their vantage point? He's wearing a dress. Is it hurting anybody? No. The bathroom being used? Did the owners own the bathroom? Then shut up. This kind of like it's my garage. I'll do whatever I want in my garage mentality, which I'm more of that camp of just, kind of hedonism, muscular hedonism is probably where I'm at.
And I will absolutely take that misinformed and yet openly accepting point of view. I think that's a perfectly fine place to compromise with people who still don't care to understand or believe in, let's see, for lack of a better term, gender dysphoria, but still say, yeah, but what are they asking for? Oh, yeah, that doesn't affect me one bit. So that's fine. I think that level of social conservatism is perfectly in keeping with America as a liberated and free country.
Yeah, I think that is one of the distinctions I've noticed the last few years is I do think there's a difference between tolerance and acceptance, or tolerance and celebration. And I think that they're actually very different muscles. And I prefer tolerance, because I think tolerance kind of lends itself across the board to other forms of tolerance. And it's becoming increasingly underappreciated, I think, of someone that can go in and go, you know what, I don't necessarily agree with this person, but they're a neighbor. I'm going to invite them to our 4th of July party. I'm going to be real nice. Like, I appreciate that. I'm kind of, I hail from little groups of people that are like that, that I appreciate that.
My thing boils down to, I love the idea of tolerance as official policy, acceptance as social contract, and then celebration as a personal sphere.
Okay.
So in other words, my ideal world would be one in which the laws were tolerant, the community was accepting, and your family would celebrate you no matter who you are. I think as long as we have that kind of rubric, then you don't have to completely accept and celebrate and embrace people who live completely differently from you. And in a large and diverse country like ours, nobody's going to be completely exposed to every different kind of lifestyle or background or culture. For example, we started this off talking about the military. I have no military history in my family. I have very few friends who are even in the military. I don't understand the military, and sometimes that lends me to have some pretty stupid opinions against the military. But I understand that under that rubric, if somebody were in my family to enlist and then go overseas and fight, I would probably change my mind, because at that point I would flip from ignorance to celebration. I'm glad there's enough tolerance blanketing it all to keep me from, like, you know, going out there and trying to ban the military or
taking part in some kind of anti-military protest or something to that effect, where you're trying to flip it.
So that's all we're asking for. So that's the ick factor that pervades kind of this entire debate.
Karina, I think your base level desire to simply live in peace is way over the line. And I can't countenance it. Simply not possible. We need to treat this as a political football to divide Americans further. I do not think we've been divided enough. So how dare you attempt to solve this?
Let us not live at peace, then. Let's live in war. I enlist.
Can I tell you my take on transgender stuff as a whole, which you know, please weigh in on this. I think that this is, to a large extent, and we'll get to the military stuff in a minute, or maybe we won't, but kind of the broader issue of transgender. I look at it and I go, I don't think that this needs to be a fight. It would seem to me that, from my vantage point, there's basically one of two phenomena happening. Either there is a biological phenomenon similar to what we think happens with homosexuality, where someone is born with a particular gender and they have a sexuality that doesn't correspond to that with the rest of the population. That very well could be happening. I lean towards that, where someone is born with an outward biological gender, but they have a mental configuration that lends itself elsewise, in which case I would assume that the person that is in this variant camp has probably had a very difficult time and is deserving of compassion and respect from people around them. The other possibility is that it is all psychological, that there's not an actual genetic component to it, but it is a form of gender dysphoria. And if that's the case, I likewise default on the position that this person's probably had a very difficult time and is probably very deserving of compassion and respect. And then I kind of top it off with me hailing from Oklahoma. I feel like a part of the etiquette I was raised with is just to sort of address people as they want to be addressed. So if someone says, you know, I don't like it when you call me Mister, it makes me feel old. I want you to call me by my first name. It's Jordan. Okay, I'm going to call that person Jordan. So I'm kind of I feel like so long as we're rooting all of this in empathy and respect and generally using the etiquette that we tend to like as a culture, I don't think this needs to be a giant societal flashpoint.
I agree. And I think you laid it out very well there in terms of where the science is at this point, the actual scientific evidence for gender dysphoria or this sort of gender opposition, internal gender opposition. We have not yet determined whether this is a mental issue or a physical issue or a social issue. It's probably a combination of all three, to be honest. And I think that is why gender expression is much more spectrum-based even than sexuality, because you can have potentially some sort of psychological issue that is really eating you up, but it doesn't extend itself to any social discomfort. So you're like, I'd rather express myself as gender neutral to ease the psychological burden I have about my gender, but I don't really care how society sees me. You know what I mean? There's a whole panoply of, there's no two trans people who have the same exact set of issues.
Interesting.
But they all do have issues, and they're probably coming from all three of those spheres. And until science can identify, you know, a source, if that's even possible, I think we have to have that attitude that you have of, let's just have some compassion for people who are clearly struggling with their bodies and their lives in a way that I can't imagine.
And it, I mean, it sounds to me like, based on what you're saying, Karina, that you don't have a 100% full throttle decisive position of, you know, this is a lockstep biological phenomenon. You're not really like...
I don't. I actually...
I imagine you've got a feeling about it going through it, but
yes.
It seems like you're kind of open to empirical data one way or the other.
Absolutely. And I cringe a little bit when trans advocates or transgender community embraces a little too hard any unproven science. Because what I fear is that we'll jump on some sort of fuzzy brain activity, EKG, or uncompletely proven DNA strand, and we'll create some sort of a test that many people who genuinely experience gender dysphoria would fail. But because they don't pass that scientific test, they would be denied rights. So I don't think we're there yet, and I think we have to keep a nice open mind. And that might be, I have a whole hour-long TED Talk on this that we don't need to get into, but...
Oh, I should have watched that. I didn't know you had a TED Talk. That would have been good prep for this. All right.
It's all in my head. Nobody's invited me to do it.
Okay. But, I feel better then.
I personally have not felt a strong psychological burden, which is one of the reasons it took me so long to come out. And there were other factors at play. I also think there's a third factor you didn't bring up that, for lack of a better term, is sort of your soul. Who you were born with, that part of ourselves that science hasn't described one bit and that religion describes in great detail. But if you're not religious, like I'm not religious, you don't know what word to call it. But I feel like there's this personality or soul component that gets underplayed when talking about what does it mean to feel like a different gender in a society than the one that you were, you know, assigned, you know. So,
and I would assume that that would be fairly uncomfortable. That is my presumption, is that it fairly uncomfortable and probably not a lot of fun, because I, particularly depending on what station you are in life, if you're in high school or college or something, I could see that being, you know, like if you're in your 40s and you live in L.A. or something, it may not be quite as impactful. But I was reading some of the suicide attempt rates. They're very, I mean, they're alarmingly high
in
general, but particularly for adolescents.
Yes, I would always say that for some transgender people, the pain threshold is very high to the point of suicide, and that is a very prevalent thing in our community. And then for other people like myself, it's more at that level. Do you ski at all?
Do I ski? No, but thank you for thinking I might.
Okay, well, yeah, I don't know. You seemed very white.
I'm very, very white, Karina. I move into a neighborhood and immediately like the quality of the coffee shops just increases. Everybody's credit rating goes up. It's yes, you're correct.
Well, this might not hit home for you, but maybe some of your listeners, this metaphor. When you ski, you put on ski boots to hold your ankles still. They're very uncomfortable. You wear them all day, and there's no better feeling than at the end of the day when you take those off and put regular shoes on. That is an indescribably blissful feeling. That's what it feels like to finally live in the gender that expresses yourself the best. It's like this, I did not even know I was in pain, but now that it's gone, I am free and I'm better and I'm happier. And that's what is another significant proportion of the trans population. And I'm just wary of any test that's like, oh, you have to be in extreme pain to walk down this path at all. I think we all should be free to find the expression of our gender that best fits our whatever it is.
Sure, and that's
soul,
where I go to, like, you mentioned a minute ago that, you know, people would be denied rights if they fail it. I don't like the idea of rights coming from a group. I think we should just all have universal rights by virtue of being individuals. But one of those things I would say is that you were at liberty to define yourself how you choose, and the people around you are at liberty to interpret that how they so choose. So if you're, you know, if you're a conservative and you're like, I really think this is a guy in a dress or whatever, that's up to you. I don't think the state has any real business defining who or what people are in that capacity. So I take a step back and go, that seems like something that ought to be in the private sphere from my vantage point.
Yes. And now that's when we start to get into how the state at least monitors a person's gender in terms of putting it onto identification documents and assigning it on birth certificates. Should that even be done? There's arguments for and against that, and I think it's perfectly okay as a just identifying characteristic along the lines of hair color, eye color, height, whatever. But it should be mutable. I think it should be something that a person can adjust, just as they might adjust their height, weight, hair color, or eye color. So that's where we get into your second part of the transgender military ban, the kill factor, you called it.
Right.
The readiness factor of someone experiencing gender dysphoria. And to me, that debate is very haveable, and yeah. I think it's less clear cut. However, I think that's really a debate about gender in the military, not transgender.
Interesting. Unpack that for me.
I think that's a much older, more historical debate about men and women serving in a military capacity and whether there are different capacities for men than there are for women. How we parse that out and how we adjudicate that. I think that's a very haveable debate. Being transgender doesn't lift you up and above gender. It just resituates you within that gender alignment. And I think there's, you know, we've traditionally had debates about should women serve in the, you know, the so-called front lines or in what capacity do we allow women? I personally lend myself more to let women do all the roles. But at the same time, I'm not a military expert. I'm not aware of the physical and mental requirements that may have very good statistical evidence, you know, that we should say these roles are a little bit more reserved for men.
Yeah, I'm in much the same camp, and that
I'm
my
more sympathetic to
my,
that.
My default position is to go the Israeli military seems incredibly integrated from a gender perspective, and they're doing fine. But at the same time, though, I will say that, like, you know, I've got friends in the military, and I'll talk to them, and it is I am open to their vantage point on that, where one of the things that's brought up, which isn't, as you point, it's not really a transgender thing, it's a gender thing. I've spoken to a couple people that have said that if they're in a situation where they're going behind enemy lines, and their orders are if someone gets detained or left behind, leave them. You have to get back. Leave them. They need to. They'll say, like, in all point of fact, I'm not going to leave a woman behind. I will leave a man behind. And that's going to alter the nature of the mission. And I'm like, well, okay, that's a good thing to know. That kind of makes things murkier for me in terms of if we're getting into sort of, you know, deep-set human psychology and things like that. When it goes to the transgender issue, I read through most of the Mattis memo in preparation for this, and a few other things as well. Some of the things that they focus on, I think are, I'm more open to. Some of them I'm not. So, for example, one of the big things in the Mattis memo is whether or not there has been or will be elective surgery, and I could see that if you were approaching that from a medical perspective, that makes sense to me, because the rate of people that are rejected from walk-ins in the military is somewhere between 71 and 80%. I've seen conflicting figures there, but it's a very, very high rate of people that aren't let in. So I could see it where if it's something to the effect of, if me, Andrew Heaton, had a low testosterone rate, I seem like that kind of guy, and I wanted to get on testosterone treatment, it might be, look, there's no problem with you as a person. It's just that we have a policy that hormones have like an open question mark in terms of psychological efficacy during a stress situation. So I could see something like that where it's not aimed at there's something sinful about you that we dislike, but rather an effect of it. But then there are other things where I look at it and go, well, I'm not sure I feel comfortable with that. Like one of the phrases in the Mattis report that's used several times is unit cohesion. And that is to say, how is the unit going to operate, and how is it going to, how closely will it operate if there are transgender people in it? And I think the argument would be, well, if transgender people serving in a platoon are going to inhibit the unit cohesion, we should not let them in. And I think and go, well, you know, there probably was an internal debate during World War II, at least initially, about whether or not to integrate the troops. And you could have tried to stop that process by going, look, like if you have mixed races in the same platoons, there's a lot of people that don't like black people or whatever, and it's going to inhibit the social cohesion. And I go, well, you know, I think we as a people have kind of decided that that's just not something that we're gonna put up with. That that's you know, racial integration is a thing. Or conversely, if there was like one particular, like if say people just really didn't like gypsies, and they were like, well, that could affect unit cohesion because there's a very anti-gypsy bias. I'd go, well, I don't think that that's, I don't think that's sufficient to overcome that hurdle.
I mean, we train our soldiers to ignore a lot of things that their bodies don't want to do. We train them to ignore pain. We train them to ignore kind of their own internal decision mechanisms so that they'll follow orders. Can't we train them to not be prejudicial? I mean, isn't that, you would think that could be piled on to the rest of the psychological training that goes into just good soldiering?
I would think so. However, my rebuttal to that would be, based on my conversation with military friends, there is a uncanny stratospheric level of teasing which occurs in the military. I don't think that the teasing is necessarily the same thing as bigotry. In fact, I don't think it is. I think it's almost like a different language where it's kind of, if you've ever been through hazing or something in a minimal capacity where it's sort of, I'm making fun of you, but it's a form of bonding. I don't think you're going to get rid of that. And I think you would create problems if you attempted to sort of excise little pockets of that out of it so that, you know, we're going to tease people, but not on one or two things. I think that would almost, that would create a weird bubble.
I'm not talking about hazing and teasing. I think you sign up for the military, you know what you're getting into, if you're, you know, anything. But what they're implying when they say unit cohesion is that somehow the morale up to the point where the soldiers wouldn't shoot or wouldn't have each other's back or wouldn't follow orders. And to me, that's absurd. Or that is a bigger problem than any particular group being in or out. If you have that kind of a discipline problem in your military, it seems like you have a bigger thing to tackle. Now, if you're talking about we want to make sure our military is a nice and happy place to be, that's also absurd. I mean, of course the military is not going to be a go along, get along, everybody's having a great time and nobody's feelings get hurt kind of a place. It's the dang military. You're shooting at people, you're killing people, and you're dealing with that psychologically however you have to, and you're teasing each other, and, you know, I wouldn't be the first person to get on a bandwagon saying that not only should trans people serve, but they should never hear a bad joke about, you know, come on.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I was about to say that would be a difficult thing to regulate. Yeah. But no, you make a good distinction though. There is a distinction between ribbing and teasing, which would probably occur, I would assume, particularly given, you know, showering situations and whatnot. However, that is different than say, you know, not functioning in a military scenario where you're in combat or something to that effect. They are categorically different, I would think.
Absolutely.
What about, like, one of the other things that I read about, and I'm kind of on two minds of it. There's a much higher suicide attempt rate within the transgender community than there is within the non-transgender community. It's around I think around like 40% or so. It's very high. And so as a general preface to this, that's terrible. I don't want anybody to be depressed. I don't want anybody to be suicidal, and I want everybody to get better. But I could see from a military perspective going, if you're from a group that has that high of a suicide rate, it might be problematic in a conflict scenario. Ergo, we're going to default on the side of caution.
Gosh, maybe they should do something about the high suicide rate amongst veterans then.
And actually, I'll say, like, getting into I deep dived this a little bit, and I thought about that, and I went, okay, what if I take this to other extremes? So what if you broke it down by suicide rates by race, then it would become very problematic because I had no idea the rate of white suicides. This is not in the military, I want to say. This is suicides in the general population. The suicide rate of white people is about 3 times higher than African Americans or Hispanics. So there's a very wide suicide disparity there. So if you were going to try and peg specific groups and go, you know what, there is a correlation, you'd actually have to create like a racial hierarchy within the military, which sounds like a very, very bad idea to me.
Yep, exactly. There's a lot. That's where I keep going back to the well with why should there be a ban against transgender people? Because most of the arguments made for a ban could be applied to any subgroup. And if we're not applying that same logic to other subgroups, then what's unique? What's different here? And it does usually boil down to the ick factor that we already identified and kind of, you know, dealt with as a not very rational thing. And the other thing, this is, somebody tweeted this and I just thought it was brilliant. What about the advantages of being transgender and joining the military? Who's going to be a better spy than someone who was literally from birth practiced being somebody that they're not and integrating themselves into a society they don't feel like they belong to. That's a well-trained spy right out of the bat. You know what I mean?
So
what are the psychological benefits of having gender dysphoria that you could apply in a military context?
I hadn't thought about that. That's interesting. So, and presumably the person might not, in a spy scenario, operate as their preferred gender in order to maintain a lower, but they're operating in a spy persona. But you're thinking
yes.
that there could be psychological benefits to that. That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
Absolutely. There's a famous French soldier from the time of pre-Napoleon, late 18th century, named the Chevalier d'Eon, who was intersex, possibly transgender, but more provably intersex.
What is intersex? I'm unfamiliar with this term.
He was born with both sets of genitals.
Gotcha. Okay.
He/she. Yeah. And they switched from male appearance to female appearance on a mission to Russia in order to infiltrate the court of the Tsar as a lady-in-waiting, and stayed there as a spy for 4 years successfully. And then came back and then flipped back to male for military service in the Seven Years' War, and then went off to England and flipped back to female as a diplomatic mission. And that was an amazing thing for a person to pull off, and it was only because that person could plausibly flip between genders and presentation that, you know, it was successful. So I think if you can get to a base level of acceptance about what gender dysphoria is and that it does exist, you can start to look at this military service thing from a very different perspective. Instead of a detriment or a handicap, it can just be like a set of different abilities, honestly. Logistics, the amount of logistics that are involved in successfully transitioning physically, the amount of medical treatments and the amount of like social navigations, it's somebody you'd want to plan a campaign for sure, because you have to think really hard to get all this stuff pulled off in the right order in the right way.
Interesting. On kind of a lighter note, I think this was, from the 90s, but there was a comedian who had a point about back when we were debating whether or not openly gay people could serve in the military. There was a comedian that was like, I think that would be fantastic to send to the Middle East. Have an openly gay platoon that's very gay and send them in like that, like to, you know, countries that are far more opposed to homosexuality. Like, there's kind of a shock warfare element going on there psychologically. And I was like, yeah, I could kind of see that, actually.
Yeah, I mean, that's not the number one reason I would go to. But
yeah,
I mean,
honestly, it probably works as a better pithy joke than it does as a military strategy. I will concede that very, very quickly.
I do like the idea of if we go into a very like kind of misogynistic culture of just changing the military uniforms to all be long flowing dresses with tiaras just to freak them out. I mean, for everybody, all the soldiers. Yeah.
Yeah, I could. That could be fun. I'll back away from the transgender military for a moment and just kind of field a couple of questions to you in general. You mentioned gender dysphoria a moment ago. My understanding is that gender dysphoria is that is the emotional state of the emotional discomfort of having mismatched gender and biological sex. Is that your read on it? I ask this because I don't want to inadvertently say this is a pathology. If that's not
right.
What I mean.
It is treated as pathology for medical coverage reasons right now. I think most people in the transgender community would prefer for it not to be pathologized, but at the same time, we do want those medical benefits, so it stays on the books. That's a very complicated issue. But yes, there is definitely, for reals, a feeling of gender dysphoria that ranges from discomfort to full-on distress.
Okay.
Like literally looking in a mirror is a painful experience. For the people who are at the distress end of the scale, I think it is a pathology that does need to be medicated and dealt with. For those at the discomfort end of the scale, it's more of a conveniently legalistic term that allows us to pursue medical treatments for something that is very real but not necessarily rooted in hating how we look.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that was a fantastic explanation. Thank you. And then to really back away from the military band for a moment, what has your experience been as a comedian? Because you're doing stand-up as a transgender person.
Oh, it's been great. And I mean, I'm in Austin, Texas, which is not a very socially conservative city. And so the amount of general blowback is much less than I might be experiencing in certain other social areas of the country. But no, in point of fact, I was surprised at how positive that experience has been. And also how receptive audiences have been, not just in Austin, but around the country, to someone in my situation getting on stage and joking about it in an informative way. I think it's just causing a ton of relief in an audience to finally hear somebody who's not offended, who's not mad at you, who's willing to make jokes about it, but is still teaching you something and answering questions you've always wanted to ask, but you know are not a great thing to ask people just flat out. So
that makes a lot of sense to me, because I do think this is one of those things where there's a lot of very angry people who don't really have skin in the game, who are either coming from the progressive side, who might be angry that someone's not using the right pronouns or whatever, or might not know what they are, and then people from the other side that might feel transphobic, or they've got they're bothered by something outside of the norm, and it's creating a lot of cultural tension right now. So I would think if I were in an audience, I'd be like, oh good, like this is, you know, someone's not going to yell at me, they're going to make jokes and kind of explain what's going on. I would like that.
Yeah, it's a great, and tension relief is what laughter is. Yeah. And so humor is the perfect way to approach this. And I stumbled upon it. I mean, I didn't become transgender to further my comedy career or anything
would,
like that. It's
that would be a
around.
Very interesting move if that you're sitting there going, I hate open mics. I'm so tired of open mics. How can I bypass these awful open mics? I know. I will just make this swiggle around gender, and this will be the niche.
God, I would be such an awful person if I did that. Well, it has turned out to be like, wow, this is a really great vehicle for humor. And this is kind of what I think people need right now, that to talk about this in a funny way.
Well, actually, like one of the things that, because, you know, I met you in Austin, I think the day I left, actually, because I went to a mutual friend of ours, Ashlyn Viscosi, puts on a great conference in Austin. And you were doing a seminar on kind of breaking down humor, which was fascinating. And I took notes on. I enjoyed it. And I reached out to you about a month ago, and my hesitancy to bring you on, Karina, was not the issue that we're talking about. It was more like I wasn't really sure whether you wanted to be known as the transgender comedian or whether you wanted to be a comedian who is transgender, and I didn't want to tokenify you. Are you comfortable where you are? Do you like going out and doing that? Do you wish you could take a step back?
I appreciate your approach to that. I mean, I think I put jokingly on my website in the bio at the very end, for SEO purposes, I will now mention that I'm a transgender comedian. I mean, that's where I am with it. I acknowledge that this is, and I'm not the only one. There's dozens of us around the country, at least, who are all very good. But it's a very small minority, and I'm going to represent it whether I choose to or not. And I try to transcend that and also just be a solid comedian, and I think I do that successfully, more or less, but I also embrace the idea that, hey, if we need someone to speak about transgender issues who's comfortable doing so and can do it with a little bit of humor, I'm absolutely game for that.
Nice. I will wrap it up on that. And Karina, I've really enjoyed talking to you, and I want to thank you. I was a little bit nervous about this topic because it is such a minefield right now in the culture wars, and I think it can be very uncomfortable. I thought it was a lot of fun talking to you, and I learned some stuff, and I appreciate you coming on.
Oh, absolutely. I had a great time. I can't wait to hear perspectives from somebody who's in the military. I think that's a good approach.
Yeah, and I want to throw this out, too, because I know there are a lot of listeners that are probably more on the conservative side or more on the socially conservative side. While I stand by my ick factor on this, I think it's very possible that there's a gaping hole in terms of my understanding of military preparation or that kind of thing. And welcome your feedback on that, because I'd like to cover this as widely as I can and as thoroughly as I can. So thank you for being on, Karina. Thank you guys for listening.
Thank you so much.
All right, gang, before we wrap up, a little bit of listener feedback. This is a review from iTunes, which I kindly ask you to visit if you've not yet rated and reviewed the show, assuming you like the show. If you don't like the show, go play Canasta or email me. But if you like it, go to iTunes. I would review your podcast. That's how nice a guy I am. Far Too Enjoyable to Be Good for You wrote of this podcast, but it is oh so good for you. I also recommend the sponsors he had highly. Snuffy's off Route 44 is a great place to bring your horse. Just ignore those signs that tell you no horses. That's just a part of the tchotchkes. Still can't find the Utterwater Bank, though. Okay. First of all, thank you. I'm glad you enjoy the podcast. I really am. And I'm glad that you enjoy Snuffy's, which is a fine diner off Route 44 where the waitstaff rides horses. Don't bring your horse to Snuffy's. I've clarified this many times now. It is otherwise just a normal diner. The waitstaff rides horses. You don't bring your horse. Don't bring your horse and park it outside. Certainly don't try and bring it into the diner. If you see a sign that says don't bring your horse inside, that's not fun Americana. That's an actual sign to please acknowledge. Okay, thank you. Remember, you can always tweet me at Mighty Heaton or Facebook me at facebook.com/MightyHeaton or even email me by subscribing to my newsletter at MightyHeaton.com and just replying when I send it out, usually on Fridays. I'd also like to encourage you to subscribe to Blaze TV and download the Blaze TV app. If you do, you can watch me instead of just listening to me. Use the promo code Heaton to get $10 off your annual Blaze TV subscription. I look like Gordon Friedman with LASIK. That is a Half-Life 2 reference, graciously given to me by a listener. So download Blaze TV app on iTunes or Google Play, get subscribed to The Blaze, and then fall in love with me more than you already are. You can also watch portions of the show on Facebook Watch by going to facebook.com/HeatonTV. Finally, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. That helps other people discover this here political orphanage. Thank you, and good day.